Hello and welcome to the Green Room Golf Course podcast from the British and International Golf Greenkeepers Association. Thanks for listening to this podcast, which sheds a light upon the golf industry and what it takes to maintain a modern course. I hope you enjoy the show. Hi everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of the podcast. It's been a couple of weeks since you've heard my voice. Some of you are probably thinking that's not a bad thing, and that's because we've been sharing episodes of Continue to Learn Extra with you. That webinar series has been a resounding success with some great guests and industry experts on there, and we're hoping that'll continue indefinitely, really, for the long run. It'd be fantastic to see. Whether you're furloughed or you're still at work, the webinars and all the other online offerings we've been able to deliver bigger members throughout this difficult period have, I hope, helped you to continue your professional journey. I've certainly been proud to be a part of a group of people who've been working incredibly hard for members and also making sure greenkeepers have had a say when the major decisions facing the sport have been taken. You may not be aware, but we've been working closely with the R&A and all the home unions and the PGA and the GCMA. At many points we've been leading the discussion, and that's something we can all be proud of. What an episode we've got for you this week. It's VE Day, and that means the country is off work, celebrating the achievements of those who fought in the Second World War and were victorious. But it's another victory that we're focusing on today, and one that's much more relevant with the current crisis. Les Howkins is course manager at the Richmond in London. He's also a master greenkeeper, and many of you will know him as the former chairman of the association preceding Scott Reeves. What many of you may not know is that we almost lost Les recently. Although he was never tested positive, Les almost certainly contracted coronavirus and spent weeks in bed, with paramedics even called out to his house when his situation got very dire. It's a scary story, but a reminder of just how serious this virus can be, and how serious we should all be taking it. I think you'll be shocked at some of the things Les has to say. Afterwards, we've got last Thursday's Continue to Learn Extra session with Dave Cottrell. I hear it was a really interesting and relevant talk about how to cope with stress and stop it controlling your life, so that's worth sticking around for. As always, this podcast is presented ad-free thanks to the support of bigger members, and if you've got any feedback or suggestions for topics and conversations, please feel free to get in touch. Contact details are in the show notes, and I hope you enjoy this episode.
Hello?
Morning, Les. It's Carl. How are you doing?
All right, mate. How are you?
Yeah, I'm all right. Thanks, bud. Are you out on the course?
Yeah, I'm halfway through cutting something, but it's alright, because we're all right. Golfers.
This, to be fair, this conversation's probably not going to have anything to do with greenkeeping or anything like that. It's going to be just you, to be fair, talking about what you went through. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Cool, alright. So, let me just ask this question first and foremost. Did you have coronavirus?
I was never officially tested to see if I had coronavirus, but the three doctors and paramedics I spoke to were 95% sure that I had coronavirus.
Okay. So that's almost a certain yes. Obviously, not everybody's getting tested, so that's kind of the advice. Why did you speak to paramedics?
Fourth day of being poorly, my breathing got very, very laboured. It was a struggle to breathe. And my wife was talking to the NHS hotline, the 111 number, and he was asking questions to me and my wife and what have you. And one of the questions was, can you stick your tongue out? And basically, I couldn't. And it just went, when I tried to stick my tongue out. And the guy at the end was obviously a medic of some description. He just went, paramedics are on the way, I've just ordered it for you. And I was like, oh shit. Because then you think, oh Christ, this must be serious. So yeah, that's why the paramedics had to come out to my house.
Okay. How bad did it get?
Yeah, it was bad enough from said paramedics. It was pretty bad. I didn't get out of bed for 13 days. Day 3, 4, 5, and 6 were probably the worst ones. When it hurt to breathe, breathing was very short and sharp. You know, my breath rate was sort of like very, very high, breathing sort of like 25, 30 times a minute, which apparently you're not meant to do. So
you're panting, gasping.
Yeah, that's a good description actually. Yeah, it was a very, very much a sort of like a pant. So.
Wow. Okay. Wow, scary. I mean, were you scared?
I wasn't overly scared, if I'm honest, because obviously to me, I knew how I felt and I knew, you know, what my body was sort of like going through. But my wife was scared. Mm-hmm. Properly scared, because me saying, "Oh, I'll be all right," didn't really cut it for her. So she was scared and what have you. But me, I just sort of like I do everything else, just took it as another day.
You do when you're, I suppose, sometimes when you're the person that's actually going through it, you have a sense of yourself, don't you? Where other people watching you don't have that same.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I mean, I knew I was poorly. I knew I couldn't get up and walk around and stuff like that. But, you know, for my wife and my two daughters to see me lying there, not able to move, not able to get up, you know, I can imagine was pretty scary. You know, because I'm the sort of guy that doesn't really sit still very often.
Yeah.
You know, so, yeah.
Okay, fair enough. Would you take me back to the start? Take me back to the start, because we are talking a little way ago now, middle of March. What was the first sign that something was wrong?
Well, I'd been at Ipswich, at the Textron HQ, to present at the FTMI. Mm-hmm. And whilst I was actually doing my workshop on budgeting, my phone rang. It was the school where my daughter goes to school. And they never phoned, so I thought, I'm just going to have to answer this, really sorry. So I answered it, and it was a school that said, "Oh, you know, Chloe's not feeling great, she's got a temperature and what have you, can't get in touch with your wife, what do you want to do?" And I was like, "Well, I'm a few hours away from being at home, but she'll be okay, because obviously living in the golf course, there's other people there, so if she wants to go home, that's fine." So she went home, and then I left Ipswich at, I don't know, 1 o'clock, 1:30, something like that, drove home, couple of hours, no problem at all, got in the house, saw my daughter, you know, gave her a drink, she had some paracetamol, so she was tucked up in bed. I felt absolutely fine. You know, the other one comes out from school, we have tea, cook, wash up, that sort of thing. And about 9:30 on that evening, I was sat watching a film, and I thought, God, my feet are freezing, and my feet felt cold. So I thought, I'm just going to go to bed. So I turned the telly off, and in the time it took me to turn the telly off and walk the 7 or 8 yards to my bedroom, it was like I'd just been hit with a shovel. Everything hurt, my knees, my ankles, my hips, my arms. It was just like fluid come on instantly. And I got into bed, and I was lying there sort of like shivering and shaking and what have you. And the wife went, "Oh, yeah," I said, "Oh, I feel like I've got the flu." So I took some paracetamol and a drink, went to sleep, didn't think anything of it really. And then the following morning, you know, the lads obviously were waiting for me to turn up for work. Ben was away in Sawgrass, so my deputy was in Sawgrass. So I got up and I walked over the yard, and I literally stood the other side of the yard and went, "I'm not feeling great, I'm going back to bed, these are the jobs for the day," and what have you. And that walk, I mean, if it's 80 yards from my front door to the sheds, that's all it is, and it nearly killed me. It was like I'd run a marathon. And that was the start, really. Got back into bed and never moved.
Wow. Scary. So, is there thought that you may have caught it off your daughter?
Potentially. I mean, kids, you know, a lot of kids get such mild symptoms. You know, following day she got up and she was fine. It was all like a 24-hour thing for her. Mm-hmm. Bit of a temperature, no cough, Yeah, so she was fine, went back to school. But on that Friday, so when I'd been over to the shed, my wife phoned the doctor and said, what should we do? And said, right, you'll have to, paracetamol, fluid, blah, blah, blah. And you'll have to, as a family, you'll have to self-isolate. And she said, the kids have gone to school. And the doctor went, right, okay, well, I'll phone the school and we'll send them home. So the doctor's surgery phoned the school to tell them to send the kids home. Wow. So, yeah, my kids have been locked up now for, I don't know, nearly 60 days.
60 days?
Yeah, so I'm trying to think now, 56 days today, my kids haven't been out. So they've been out of the house, but they haven't been outside the confines of the golf course for 56 days.
Well, they're fortunate they live on a golf course, I suppose. Cause
they are very fortunate, and they know, they understand how fortunate they are as well.
Coronavirus, it's all anybody's talking about. You don't imagine that it's going to impact you. I mean, you were basically got it when lockdown was announced, wasn't it? It was like that.
Yeah. I was a week into it before they announced. The doctors phoned me every day for a couple of days after that, and
right.
You asked them, and they were like, yeah, all the symptoms you've got, almost certainly what it is.
And what was, so you had that low point in the first week where, sounds like it was pretty, pretty scary times. What's the recovery been like for you?
The first week was the worst. And then that second week where I was still in bed, nothing really changed for about 7 or 8 days. And it was just really tired, no energy, everything ached, and breathing. Although my breathing was okay, it hurt. When I breathe, if I took a deep breath in, I'm a non-smoker. I've never smoked. But if you ever get like a mouthful of someone else's smoke when you're walking down the street or something, it like burns inside. And that's what it was like every time I took a deep breath. It was like it was burning that right down deep inside my lungs, not in my throat. Right down deep. Mm-hmm. And it was like that, well, for about 4 weeks, really. But I'll say that nothing got better for a week. And then on the 13th day, I had a sleep in the middle of the afternoon. And when I woke up, I thought, Christ, I feel a lot better. And I got up and I had a shower. I actually put clothes on for the first time in nearly 2 weeks. I put a pair of jeans and a T-shirt on. And I had a cup of tea and a biscuit and sat on the sofa, and I was like, I feel a lot better. And every evening when the golf club was all locked up, my wife and kids had just been going for a little walk around, outside just to get some fresh air. And I thought, I'm going to go for a walk. And my wife was like, what? I said, yeah. I said, I feel like going for a walk. So I walked for 500 yards to the end of the drive and back again. And I was pretty tired at the end of it, but felt a lot better for being outside in the fresh air and two for doing it. And then the next day I woke up and just felt better and better every day. Got my energy back. Every day got better. But I was always tired. I mean, for the first week back at work, I'd finish work at 2:30 and go and have a sleep, which again is not something I would normally do. And then I'd say the ongoing recovery probably took another, it was four weeks after I got out of bed. And again, the cold mornings, it would hurt to breathe, sleeping a lot at night, sleeping 8, 9, 10 hours instead of the usual 4 or 5. And then all of a sudden one day, it was like, oh, I'm back to normal. And I felt instantly better. And then, a week or so now, felt absolutely great. So,
six weeks almost in total. How long have you been back at work? What have you been doing?
I went 2 weeks. 2 weeks after that Thursday at FTMI, I came back to work on the Friday. But I'll be honest with you, I wasn't really working. I was sat on my buggy and I just drove round and looked at stuff and waved at the guys and made sure everyone was keeping away from each other and, you know, make sure they were disinfectant in the machines and stuff. So, I say, for a good week or so, I literally just sat on my arse because, you know, so doing anything physical would really take it out of me and get me out of breath sort of thing.
Yeah, of course, it's, you know, it's from what you hear, it's 2 weeks before, if you infect somebody, it's 2 weeks before you then they get symptoms. That's what you hear. So you must have been sort of worried for those 2 weeks, whether you were capable of being worried at that point when you were really ill, or, you know, worried of, is everybody else going to get ill? Do you know?
You're absolutely right. And my one thing, because obviously I've been at HMI, I was just like, oh my God, what if I've infected everyone there? You know, that was my thing. I was like, what if I've just given 24 young greenkeepers and the mentors and Jim and Sammy and, you know, what if I've just infected all of them with bloody coronavirus? And I was properly gutted. You know, I think, you know, I let Jim know straight away, and I think he communicated with the people that were there just to be on the safe side. I haven't heard of anyone that got it from there, which is a massive relief, because I'd have never forgiven myself if, you know, if anything bad had happened to someone. So
yeah, absolutely. And obviously, I mean, you'll have seen, there's been guys that haven't taken it as seriously perhaps as they maybe should have. As somebody who's been through that, what would you say, what's been your reaction to seeing things like that, and what would you say?
Yeah, you know, yeah, I mean, knowing how I felt, I wouldn't wish it on the worst enemy. And for people that aren't taking it seriously, it's absolutely paramount to do, because, you know, you might survive, you might have a full recovery, you might just have very mild symptoms, but the guy next year, or the guy next year's wife when he gets home, could die. You know, it's that simple. And, you know, people need to take it seriously. You need to do the social distancing. You need to clean the hands properly. You need to have good practices in place for, you know, if they're at work, keeping things clean, disinfecting, making sure you're using the right disinfectant, and you know, so like doing everything that we're told. And if the government say we've got to stay in the house a bit longer, just stay in the house. You know, going to the beach with your family is not the thing to do.
Yeah, absolutely. Good message. Thanks, Les. And, well, you survived coronavirus, you survived bigger chairmanship. Is there anything that can take you down?
I've had a pretty challenging couple of weeks in the last 2 weeks at work with a complete and utter power failure to the whole site.
Wow.
Which led to us digging a trench 500 metres across the golf course to install a brand spanking new power cable that was about 3 inches across. So that's been quite testing, having no power and then running the place on generators for 2 weeks and so far. It was fairly challenging, and considering my frame of mind was perhaps not what it normally would be, it was challenging. But you know what, it didn't beat us, and I'm sort of sat here outside in the sun watching the sprinklers irrigating all the new turf we have to put down. So, you know, no, I don't think there's anything that can finish me off that easy.
Good man. All right, well, thank you very much for talking us through it. It sounds, like I said a few times, it sounds like it was pretty scary times, and obviously it's good to hear. Yeah. It's good that you're still with us, mate. I appreciate that.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I'm pretty glad that I'm still with us, still alive and kicking.
Yeah, absolutely. You've got a story to tell now.
I have indeed.
When you write that book.
Yeah, when I write my memoirs. All right, buddy. Thanks for that.
All right, bud. Thanks.
All right, see you, matey. Cheers. Bye. See you soon.
See you later, mate.
Bye, mate.
Hi, I'm Sammy Strutt, Head of Member Development for Bigger, and I'd like to welcome you to this Continue to Learn Extra webinar. I'm pleased to welcome Dave Cottrell, who will today be focusing on understanding and dealing with stress, an area of mental health that we all experience at one time or another. Dave will be focusing on how some stress can make us stronger and how the work recovery model can help us to stop stress from ever reaching boiling point. I'm sure this may be useful to many of us in the current situation that we find ourselves in. Dave has faced a lot of adversity in his life. Although not an uncommon story, his is one of turning his life around to try and help others to do the same. In early life, he believed he was a victim, then a survivor, and now he's something else. Someone who retrained as a personal trainer, nutritionist, and mindset coach to enable him to make a massive positive impact on those around him. Dave now helps people to live their life in a way where they no longer survive, but thrive. Without further ado, I will hand over to you, Dave.
Thank you so much. That was a very delightful introduction. So thank you for having me on today. It's an absolute pleasure. I think there'll be a few of you that are familiar with me. I've spoken for Bigger 4 separate times now, including Continue to Learn earlier this year. And I kind of really love it. I love getting the opportunity as well to speak to a predominantly male audience, because actually within mental health, the people that often turn up is predominantly female. And it's, you know, with the statistics in the UK in particular, and globally, show that that particularly things like depression and suicide affect men more than they actually do women. And I think a lot of that is actually not that they affect us more, it's just that we speak up about it less and we deal with it less and we don't attend events like this. So that's one of the greatest things I've found about working with Bigger, that and the fact that your staff look nearly as good in purple as me, sometimes better in purple than as I do. So I've got a bit of an obsession with purple, as you will see from the t-shirt and from the slides. So I'll do Sammy's just done an excellent introduction for me, but the important parts I like to talk about is that, because I have type 2 bipolar disorder, which is used to be referred to as manic depression. So extreme highs, extreme lows. Sometimes I show the picture that's on screen now, other times I show a cartoon of me in half a Tigger and half an Eeyore outfit, because it is a little bit like having Tigger and Eeyore from Winnie the Pooh inside my head at the same time. I can be bouncing off the walls and all woohoo some days, and I can be, that's okay, I'm just a donkey, not that anybody cares, on other days. So, but that's where I kind of come at it from, both a personal and a trained point of view. I'm a mental health first aider and I'm an assist suicide prevention coach as well. So I believe that mental health is something that we can control. It's an often a debate whether mental health is something that happens to us or something that we can actually change 100%. And I often say that the answer is somewhere in the middle for different people. Say some people, their mental health contributes more to what they can impact and what they can't. Other people can impact it nearly 100%. And that's why I say, like, a lot of times it's like just taking these pieces and actually working towards maybe even just that, those 1% incremental gains. You know, if anyone's, you know, a lot of you probably play golf as well as actually maintain greens and stuff. It's like 1%, you know, you'd do anything for like one stroke off the game, right? So this is that, it's like getting that those incremental gains. Sometimes for other people, it's like, you know, completely and utterly changing the game entirely. And stress is definitely not the only thing that contributes towards that, but it is the only thing that that every single one of us in like feels and experiences. Not every single one of you watching will experience depression, thankfully. Not every single one of you that watching will experience any personality disorder or anxiety or OCD or anything like that. Again, thankfully, but every single one of us, every single one of us deals with stress. And stress in COVID-19, which is, I call that the C word these days. It's the one I don't say on my podcast, but it's not changed. Stress itself hasn't actually changed. What is causing the stresses has the principles of stress are still exactly the same. And they come in three main components. And I'm going to talk about how each one of those components might have changed a little bit. But the principles behind stress haven't changed in this period. And the three main stresses, right, components to stress are the stress going in, so the things that make us stressed, how we handle the stress in terms of our conversation around it, our self-talk and our ability to handle it, and then the things we do to help stress out. So those three principles have been there since, you know, the dawn of time. And actually, as Sammy said in the introduction, stress is important. Zero stress and we don't actually grow. Like we need stress in order to actually develop. And it's the difference between chronic and acute stress. Acute stress, we do something that is harder for us and then we adapt to it. The actual stress models that were first as the first kind of published by Hans Selye, so wasn't called a stress model, it was called a stress and adaptation cycle. So when we put ourselves under a stress, it actually causes, under an acute stress or a short-term stress, it causes us to develop, whether that is training and actually putting your muscles under stress. You actually cause the muscles to rip, not just to kind of get stronger. They rip and break down and then body goes up. The same is true with mental health. If we don't put it under any stress whatsoever, people get complacent, they sit there, they get bored, and they feel like they've got no purpose. Like the whole use it or lose it principle, which works for muscles, works for your mind as well. You want to do things that actually do stress your brain. But the problem is we tend to have just too much of it and we tend to hold it for too long. So the situation right now in terms of stress is that it says on that slide there, stress in and how the glass is half full. Sounds like a very positive thing, right? We know that a positive person looks at the glass half full, a negative person looks at it half empty, right? What I'm talking about here is that if you imagine this container, this is juice. It's in a gin festival glass, but I promise it's not like rhubarb gin or anything, not yet anyway. But if we imagine this glass is a really good representation of kind of stress in this time. So normally each one of us has a container for stress, the amount of stress that we can take. We all have different size containers, which is why some people seem to snap easier, other people seem to be able to just take as much as possible. But the thing is, each thing that stresses us feeds into the container. And we have three different types of stress. We have physical stress, we have mental stress, and we have an emotional stress. Physical stress, like a hard day's work, you know, that is a physical stress. Going and doing a workout, a tough workout, is physical stress. Being exposed to any form of kind of like microbes and stuff in the air, extreme hot, extreme cold, and especially being physically ill, met with like with physical health, those are all physical stresses. Mental stress is the one that we think of when we say the word stress. If you say, are you under stress, to somebody, they're not going to think, have I been to the gym too much, have I been training too hard or anything like that. They're going to think, am I under mental stress? And your mental stress is things like work, is things like paying the bills, is things like making sure the kids are homeschooled and all of that. That's your mental stress. And then emotional stress is relationships and you know, fighting with the kids or fighting with your stress right now because we're at home 100% of the time, and therefore the things that any kind of little crack or niggle that was there before might be getting exposed more. And so that's, you know, those are all the different types of stress. And there's, you know, within each one of those, there's hundreds of different things that can contribute to those things. But the problem is we don't just tend to sit there and go, right, I'm having a physical stress day today, I'm having a mental stress day today, I'll deal with all my emotional stress today. No, they all come and they all go in one container. Then it's not like we've got three separate containers for them. Now, if you've got them coming in throughout the day, let's say, you know, you've got a bit of a mental stress, bit of emotional stress, bit of physical stress, keeps on going, and you get to the end of the day, and then let's say the kids don't go to bed on time. It's only a little bit. Right, it's not huge in the grand scheme of things, but it's enough to cause a spill. And then the thing is, that's basically how it does build up. We tend to blame ourselves at that point for the thing that causes it to break. Now, with stress going in right now, this glass is already half full because we've got all this uncertainty around COVID. We've got more people experiencing health anxiety than ever before. The fear of contracting a disease, the fear of touching other people, and the fear of being around other people. All of this is like the glass is already half full. And as I said, we think half full positive, but in this instance, it's a negative. So when you're actually asked to deal with all the stresses that you dealt with in a normal day, if you imagine pouring all of those stresses on top of this glass, when it's already got all that liquid in it, things going to overpour a lot sooner. And that's the stresses going in. That's step one in a nutshell, really, is that there's more stress. Even if you've only got the same amount of stress going in, or even if you're furloughed and you're actually kind of enjoying it, you feel like you've got slightly less stress going in there. So your boiling point, the tipping point, the point at which that glass is full, is happening sooner. That's point one. Point two is how we feel about stress and how we deal with it. And the number one piece of advice I would give at this point is don't compare your current self to your pre-quarantine, pre-COVID, pre-whatever self. Don't compare your current self ever to your best self either. Comparison is it's the thief of joy. It's a great Teddy Roosevelt quote. And the thing is, when we're comparing to other people and they've got more than us, it can make us feel pretty crappy. But actually, when we compare ourselves to what we could do before, the only time we feel good about that is when we can do more now than we could do back then. If we could handle more now than we could handle back then, you know, you go and do some weightlifting and let's say you get up to a 50 kilo bench press, and then you go in and you get a 55 kilo bench press one day. You're like, yes, that's more. That's a great time to use comparison. It makes you feel good, builds your momentum. But right now, whilst that glass is already half full, we're expecting the same of ourselves as what we expected before this situation happened. And as a result, when we don't reach those expectations, then we start beating ourselves up. In that first scenario where I said about the kids, you know, the 7 p.m. thing, it's supposed to be bedtime and they say one more thing and then we snap on them. That's when the overflows. We blame ourselves for the fact that I can't believe I snapped at that. And then we become even more stressed because when we self-deprecate, we beat ourselves up. I think this is another one of the reasons why the statistics are kind of worse for men than they are for women, because men often go into that and go, oh, what kind of man am I? I shouted at my wife, or I snapped at my kids, and really they weren't being that bad. And what's wrong with me? We ask ourselves that. Why can't I do this? Why can't I handle this? What's wrong with me? And each of those questions, that's our relationship with stress. That's making us feel even worse. Would be when we expect ourselves to be able to handle it. And there's an external stress right now coming from the expectations of the internet in particular. There's so many people that, like, there seems to be a big divide between the people who say you should be at home getting a new language learning how to bake and, you know, taking control of your body and getting this and your sex life should be fantastic because you've got more time and you've got more time in bed and all of this. It should be all this. And you should come out of this with your side hustle. You've been furloughed. And so you've got all that time. Should. That word. Hate it. Can't stand that word. And the thing is, this is being said by people who are high on momentum, or people who just think that they can get a lot of attention by saying these things. Sometimes the people that are saying these things don't actually have the lives that they portray online. But it's been saying a lot of times by people who've got that high momentum. They're in a fantastic situation. They've gone into this situation not really kind of too stressed about it. They're financially secure. And their business is going well, the family life's already going well. And they, you know, the type of people that are like, yeah, I'm completely and utterly self-made. And now I'm going to tell other people how to live their life too. And it's also said sometimes by some people who are just a bit ambitious and, you know, quite nice. So it's like, it's unfair of me to throw all people into that one category. But ultimately, that's being said by people who don't really understand that there isn't a one size fits all for us in terms of what we should be doing. Because when we go back to that can't handle what I handled before, the comparison, if you are in this situation and you used to being able to get out there and do like 10 straight hours on the greens, like just putting in the work and then going and spending time with the mates, then going and spending time with your family and all that stuff. And now you're struggling to get out of bed. Someone turning around and saying to you, oh yeah, you should have learned Russian by now. You should be able to crochet. You know, all these shoulds. It's like, again, we go into this dialogue of, well, they're saying that I should be doing this, should be out doing this exercise, should be doing that, should be, and I'm not. And if I should be doing and I'm not, what does that say about me? And all this is stage two, how we feel, how we relate to the stress, the line I often say to this is our brain, when it's saying these things to us, what it wants versus what it gets. What it wants is it wants us to do more. We're a species that likes to do more and likes to achieve. But the expectations, it's like you've got to ask, where are those expectations coming from and are they realistic? If those expectations are coming from someone on the internet or your mate down the street who's just handling this so much better than you, then they're not your expectations of yourself. They're not your values. If they are 100% your values and you definitely know that you want to achieve those things, then beating yourself up about it isn't going to be the way to get news about this. And this is like two legitimate friends in real life that have actually said these exact things to me. One of them will be like, "Oh, you're always busy. You never make any time for me. When can I see you?" And the other one will be like, "Oh," actually he doesn't sigh like that. Actually, I don't know why I did that. The other one will be like, "Oh, I always love spending time with you. I know we're both dead busy at the minute, but do you think like we could maybe hang out sometime soon? Can we hang out?" And if we look at that objectively, it's nice, but it's said in a way with all this baggage and emotion attached to it. And the worst person for attaching baggage and emotion to you when they talk to you is you. When we talk to ourselves, we put all of these pressure on there, saying to ourselves, "Why can't I do this? What's wrong with me?" If we were to take the filter off that, what they're trying to say is, "How could I do this? You know, what do we feel capable of right now? What can I do right now to move forward?" That's what your brain's trying to say. It's just saying it a little bit like friend one did. And we need to coach it to not do that. We need to coach it to say, "You know what, actually, I'm really proud of myself for getting up this morning, because I didn't want to, I got up before 10 this morning, whereas yesterday I was stuck in bed till half 10. You know, you might even be at the point where you don't even want to shower or don't want to brush your teeth or don't want to open the curtains. And that's when we've gone beyond stress and we're getting sort of towards depression. And expecting a person to achieve the same things when their momentum's that low it's unrealistic. But when we do, when we say, "Why can't I do this? What's wrong with me?" we make the momentum go even lower. And the way momentum works is, this is kind of like how my version of motivation. I don't believe in motivation. I just believe in momentum. I'm going to use basically crockery. Is this crockery? Glassware? So if your momentum's here and your average day of work is here, like average difficulty, if you're on a roll and you start getting, you know, things are going well in life, as this momentum goes up, the difficulty of this goes down. If you're struggling with life and you're worrying about and the stress is building up and things get harder, the difficulty, the perceived difficulty of this goes up. Now, if that continues to happen, the more you get stressed and this difficulty comes up, then the next thing you know, things like getting out of bed, brushing your hair, things like that start creeping up. And instead of the thing being the hardest thing you have to do that day, being your full day of work, then being the family man or whatever it may be, then being the mum, those being what you perceive as like 100% difficult, it does happen where things like brushing your teeth, things like cooking the kids their dinner, becomes 100% difficult. And again, we beat ourselves up, and as we beat ourselves up, that momentum just gets lower. So we need to be compassionate to ourselves. That's step two. Step one is be aware that the extra stress that's coming in right now, and that COVID does put us all under different stresses. The expression, "We're all in the same boat," we are to a degree, but we're all carrying different baggage within that boat. And that doesn't mean that your particular stresses are any less valid. They really are. And when we say we're all in the same boat, we're kind of like, well, we'll just push that stress under the carpet. And as we know, the carpet starts to lump. So that's the first two parts. The third part is about basically how we deal with stress. Now, how that's changed, you guys, in fact, have I got the Sling Shot and Boomerang thing coming up? Yes, I do. So if you've seen me do one of my talks before, you'll be familiar with the next slide. And again, this hasn't changed, but what has changed in terms of stress is that we don't get access to many of the things that we did, that we used for stress relief before. You may not have even realized certain things that you do were coping mechanisms or were good for your stress relief. Having a pint down the pub with your mates, it's like people think, "Oh, well, alcohol is bad, therefore pint down the pub with mates bad." No, not necessarily. It does. It relieves emotional stress. It causes physical stress. It relieves mental stress to a degree, and causes physical stress. The more we drink, the more that balance goes out of kilter. But there's more to that. Being in the pub, the landlord knowing your name, knowing what your order is, that feels nice. That's a good stress relief. You know, your mates being there, having a bit of a chat, having a bit of banter, maybe watching the footy together, whatever it may be. That's been taken away. The gym, leisure centers, all that stuff taken away. Expectations around exercise, you can't go out for too long, otherwise there might be some social justice warrior on social media that'll say, "You went out twice today and therefore you're a terrible human being and should be hung." And yes, there are people that actually say that, just not with that accent, because they say it on Twitter and you don't have an accent on Twitter, do you? So that's, the stress is going out. There's a lot of the things that we once did to relieve our stresses are now gone. And the thing is, what happens then is people do replace. So I've coached people in the past who've given up smoking and you know, kind of put weight on. It's not because cigarettes are the greatest diet product in the whole world. It's because the cigarettes were for the immediate release of stress for that person. And the only way that they get their immediate release of stress now is they turn to food instead. So, and sometimes that happens even automatically without a person realizing it. It's like, so, and again, it's not really down to nicotine being an appetite suppressant or anything. It's about the fact that the person needs to scratch the stress relief itch. And that'll be what a lot of you are experiencing right now, is that the gym was your stress relief and that's not there right now. Sometimes, like for me, one of the ones that it took me a little while to twig on, but I love being around my family, I genuinely do, but I also love time to myself. And I used to have like a half an hour commute to different places. I work mostly from home anyway, but I'd always have commutes, you know, that I came down to do a bigger session in Tunbridge just before lockdown happened. And you know, I read my book and listened to podcasts on the train and stuff. And I had all of that. There's traveling, which is a physical stress, but then there's also the emotional stress relief that was coming from listening to podcasts, and the mental stress relief that was coming from reading like a really trashy novel. You know, it's like, that's gone. I don't listen to podcasts as much anymore. They were one of my big stress relievers. I'd listen to at least half an hour each way, wherever, like if I was going to the local town on every single day. So that would be like kind of one of the things. Now I don't have that now. I go out in the car maybe twice a week at most, and usually it's 10 minutes down the road to Tesco's, and then I stand in a queue outside Tesco's for an hour, which is, you know, the shopping experience is now more stress than it used to be. So we've got to be aware of the fact that the things that we maybe did in the past that actually were stress relief are now no longer there. So we have to now think about what are we going to do instead. And it's not about just avoiding stress altogether. This is why I call what I do the work recovery model. It's about doing some work, doing the work, whether that is physical, mental, or emotional, and then having time to recover. The same as how a muscle builds. A muscle, you don't just build. If you do, you break the muscle down more than it can be built back up. You also don't build that same muscle by sitting on the couch the entire time, because what will happen is when your body goes, no, I don't need that muscle anymore, it'll start to shrink and it'll start to atrophy. Same thing with our ability to cope with emotional and mental stress. So we don't just want to avoid stress altogether. What we want to do is we want to minimize some of the stresses that we've got, if we can. If there are ways that we can make things more efficient, then absolutely. We need to change our relationships to stress massively. So the way we talk to ourselves, point two, is hugely important. And then point three is we need to look at the things we are doing for stress relief, which is what takes me into the slingshots and boomerangs method. Now, actually, it's all the way over there. I actually have my boomerang with me. I never have my boomerang with me when I see you guys in face to face, because it's like not big, and I don't tend to carry a giant boomerang around with me. But it's like I'd have to take my headphones off and disrupt the. No, so there we go. But this is basically my concept on the behaviors that we actually do, is the slingshots and boomerangs. Not all behaviors. Some behaviors are just forward steps and back steps. A forward step is something that takes you positively without any real effort. Okay. So like that could, and what is real effort will change from person to person. So going for an early night could be a forward step, or for some people, because it just doesn't take much effort. You just go to bed. For other people, pulling yourself off the phone, in order to get that early night actually takes a lot of effort. So that becomes a slingshot for that person. But these two types of behavior that I want you to be aware of, and they're called slingshots and boomerangs. Start with boomerangs because we get the negative one out the way first, right? So a boomerang in real life, you throw it forward and then it comes whipping back. That's the idea of a boomerang. Apparently they don't always work, but let's just pretend that they do for a moment. Now, that is a behavior that gives you a positive in the short term. Excuse me. And identifying that positive is key. What is the positive you're trying to achieve? Now, obviously, for the sake of today, we're going to assume that the positive is stress relief, but the positive can be fitting in with people in the office. In the middle of the day, you're on a diet and, you know, they offer you a donut, and actually you don't want to kind of stick out like a sore thumb. You want to fit in. So you go and have a donut. You know, it could be like alcohol can be for connection. Your friends only ever drink alcohol. So whenever you go out, you feel like obliged to do it because you want to connect with your friends and you feel like you wouldn't get that connection otherwise. But ultimately, we're going to talk about them all in the context of stress today. And boomerangs are anything that gives you stress relief in the short term. So that's the boomerang going forward to give you more stress in the long term. If we think about comfort eating, that was the one, if we go back to the pictures of me from before, the very first one I got there by comfort eating a hell of a lot. It was my probably very first vice was to comfort eat. Now, the first few times I comfort ate, it made me feel great, like for a long time. But then you get better at the things you do often. And as a result, you gain a tolerance to it. And the tolerance for me was I had to eat more in order to get the same level of satisfaction. But the problem is, what happens is I have 99 problems. I eat the food, feel great for, originally it was like hours. Eventually it became like 10 seconds. Sometimes I was already miserable again before I'd even finished eating the food. And then the boomerang comes whipping back.
I'm not sure I understand.
I'm not sure you're supposed to understand Siri. Siri doesn't half gag in on these calls. Now, so basically the boomerang goes forward and then comes whipping back, right? At the end of it, I end up with more stress than I had when I went in. Same is true if someone turns to alcohol. Same is true if someone turns to smoking. You know, I said the difference between acute stress and chronic stress, like smoking becomes a chronic stress on your body. It's like the odd cigarette, like once or twice in your life is not going to cause you that much problem. But persistent use of cigarettes causes chronic stress within the body. Your body is trying literally to return to its normality, and it can't do it. Like the speed at which the nicotine's going in and the other chemicals are going in. So food's one of them. Alcohol's another biggie. I would say a lot of people are drinking more whilst we're on lockdown. And the big key here is, do you find yourself saying, I need a drink? Or is it I just fancy a drink? And be honest with yourself on that one, please. Like, you know, because there is, again, there's no real harm in having the odd drink every now and then. But there is, as soon as even small amounts of drinking, when it becomes a need rather than a want, that's where we have an issue. Social media can be a huge boomerang for people. We go on, we feel connected in the short term, but then actually we feel like these people don't really understand us and there's no real representation of me or how I feel, and I don't feel connected at all. In fact, actually I feel aggravated because people are calling each other out for all sorts and the world seems so divided and all the rest of this. And you know, even to a degree, getting information about the current world situation can be like that. At first, it can be the right dose of it can be useful to us. The wrong dose of it, too much of it, causes more confusion and causes more panic. So these are all boomerangs. And the reverse of that is called a slingshot. A slingshot is like you pull it back, you put it under tension, and then you let it fly forward. You have to put work in first. It's an investment. If you think of a boomerang like a credit card, you think you've got money in the short term only to get debt in the long term. And investments, like you give away the money, that the liquid income in the short term, so for the hope of more money in the long term. It's the same with a slingshot. And the thing is, right now, what constitutes a slingshot can be very difficult, different for people. So again, if your momentum's come down and the difficulty has gone up on the things that are on this side, then like brushing your teeth used to be a forward step. Getting to bed on time used to be a forward step. Having a nutritious meal used to be a forward step. You know, all of these things used to just be things that you automatically did. And now they've changed and they've moved to become something that's difficult. And the trick to that really is to basically look at it and say, right, the first thing we look at and go, why can't I do this? What's wrong with me? It's like, no, how could I do this? What can I do right now to help move forward? We want to change that. We want to change that dialogue. And we want to actually start looking at what can I do today, and not judging it against what you could do before, because that will just stop you from doing things. It's like, okay, I think, again, if any of you have seen me talk live, you'll know that I like to run across the stage and talk about the idea of when we're learning to walk. And I'm going to use that. I'm going to use two versions of that now. When a kid's learning to walk and we're a parent, kid crawls over, climbs up the couch, turns around, about to take those first monumental steps, right? Now, none of us in our right minds leg it up to that child, rugby tackle it to the floor and say, don't bother doing that until you can get across the whole floor. Because we know what it'd do to that child. Now, at the same time, if your child then goes on to take 10 steps, and you're like, yes, you're amazing, you're fantastic, you take this 10 steps. If that child goes and takes only 5 the next day, just sit there and go, state it to you, you used to be able to do 10 and now you're only doing 5. Such a loser. You don't say that. And why don't you say that? Because you know what it would do to that poor child, right? But we say that type of things to ourselves up here. And that is one of the biggest contributors to our stress that we can actually change right now. It just takes practice. Negativity comes natural. Positivity takes practice. You're going to have to choose to tell yourself something different. The thoughts will still come. The thoughts of like, oh, you loser or whatever might still come. And you have to turn around and go, you know what? I don't accept that. I'm not a loser. I'm proud of myself. I'm proud about the step that I've taken to get here. I'm proud of the fact that I got out of bed today. I'm proud of the fact that I brushed my teeth today. I had a shower today. Because what will happen, just like when you say to that kid, I'm so proud of you. You're so amazing. They go back to the couch. They take the next step. They take the next step. And they take the next step. And the thing I'd like to get each of you to do is what this says at the bottom here, takeout menu, not to-do list. What I would love for each one of you to do, we need to change the relationship to stress, but we also need to change the stresses going out. I want you to write what I call the takeout menu. And the takeout menu is your list of stress busters, okay? And if you want, put things on there like have a drink or have a bit of food, but put a little bee or a little boomerang icon next to them so that when you do those things, you're aware, this is going to relieve some stress, but it's also going to give me some back, and be more conscious and aware of that. But put things on there. I've done like 2 jigsaws since I've been on lockdown, and that's honestly my favorite time. I've also been learning to draw. And I know, like, again, I said before, don't let anyone else's pressure push you into that. But I've been learning to draw for the enjoyment of it, not for the I need the achievement kind of thing, not because anyone on the internet. I've been learning to draw because I actually find that, again, I'm not reaching for my phone, which is one of my big triggers. My mind's not all over the place when I'm learning to draw. It's on that one thing. It's a form of mindfulness to me. The reason I call it, yours is not going to look like the person next to you, even though they're not next to you. It's not going to look to you, look like the person on the next Zoom window to you. They can all be different, and that is perfectly okay. And I don't like to make too many suggestions of this because I'm lazy. No, it's not because I'm lazy. It's because you guys need to come up with these yourself. It needs to be something that you can see yourself doing. But I do suggest to people, put a few things on there that you've not tried before. We get brought up with curiosity killed the cat. It's like, no. Like, if your kids turn around and say, oh, I don't like broccoli, and they've never tried it, it's like, do you allow that? It's like, now we don't tend to try new things anymore. And I would say, try out some new things. Try out like maybe meditation. I started doing face masks like every few months. You know, I put that off for a long time, you know, because, you know, I'm a bloke and all that, super manly. And they're actually fantastic. I absolutely love them. Stand-up comedy is another good one. That is a good stress relief. It's good to laugh. Write this list now and write it as long as you want, because this is why I call it the to-do list. Because when we see a list that's got 30 items on it, we look at it and go, oh, I'm not done until that's done. And we don't want that with your stress relief. If you've put 30 items, 30 different things that you can do for stress relief on a list, and you look at it and go, right, I need stress relief. I feel myself wanting to go for that beer, or wanting to kind of feel myself at that boiling point. I'm going to lash out. Oh, I feel so angry. I need stress relief. And this list is there for your help. If you look at that list and go, oh, I've got to do all of that before I get my stress relief, no bueno, no good. So what we actually want to do is we call it the takeout menu, because you don't pick up the takeout menu for like abracababra and go, right, oh God, I really fancy some dinner, and look at the menu and there's 60 items on the menu and you think, oh, I've got to eat all of that before I'm full. You go onto it, you pick the thing that you want, you maybe get a few little combo, a couple of little things that you know go well together, and you crack on, you have a nice dinner, a nice kebab. That's what I want you to do with your stress relief list. Oof, is make it a takeout menu. So make sure that you look at it and you go, right, okay, I need a split second decision because I need that stress relief now. What am I going to do? And go, well, actually, you know what? I fancy that one today. I'm going to go with that one instead. Right, that's the main presentation done. I think Sammy's already got a number of questions. So ask me anything.
Okay. Hi, Dave. That was great. We really enjoyed that.
Thank you.
I've been having a few things have been coming through on my WhatsApp during that conversation, especially the one about crochet. One of our team are particularly good at crocheting. So
excellent.
So that's been actually two of our team.
I don't think I've ever said crochet in a seminar before. You know.
And Deb, who is the crocheter, is saying, yay, thanks, in the chat screen.
Excellent.
So, a couple of questions that have come through. So we've got, as a manager, what can you do when you find yourself with a less motivated staff and negativity from your board and members? How do you avoid falling into a negative mindset?
Okay, so much of that is down to communication and understanding that people have very different communication styles. I like to use the phrase common sense isn't. So whatever you think is common sense, it's probably not. You know, it's like right now we've all been told to kind of socially distance and stuff in Tesco's, but before all that, it was like people would stop and have chats in the actual entranceway. I mean, that seems like common sense, but it isn't, right? Now, we have to understand that not everyone sees things the same way that we do. And what I would say is the biggest change for me in terms of dealing with other people, because I, you know, obviously that's what I do for a living, came from the fact that I take 100% responsibility for the communication. So if the person is being difficult to communicate, I think, how else could I do this? I try and approach the communication from a different style. And I think, because we often sit there and think, oh God, the other person should be doing some of the work here. And when we get, again, should, you can see why I hate that word, right? I call it the tennis match from hell. You know, you serve it up saying, oh yeah, I told you to do that green like 2 weeks ago. And then like, they're all like, oh, but you know, you're always kind of like nagging me just as I'm finishing my shift. And it's like, and then they knock it back in the same way. And it's like watching the same tennis match on repeat forever. You know, you say one thing to the person one way, they always reply in the same sort of way. If there's a dynamic there, and especially baggage, the longer this goes on with a person, you start anticipating that, and you're almost at the next level, like fire, you know, fighting fire with fire. It becomes this whole mess. So I would say, look at different communication styles, listen to the, ask the person more questions, ask things like, what would it take to get this done right now? Like that's usually a good one, because can you do this is a yes or no. What would it take to get this done right now? Or when can you see this fitting in? Or can you do this either this morning or this afternoon? That makes the person think they've got choices. Which again, like I said before, it's like your take-up menu needs to be one of your own choices so that you feel empowered in actually doing it. So I would say, just look up different types of communication style. And there's a really cool book called The Four Tendencies, which helps with understanding. That's where I got my big shortcut from, with how to kind of speak to a lot of different people. It helps in terms of bypassing all that. But I would say, yeah, communicate. If the communication is not working, try a different style and keep on trying a different approach until the person kind of hopefully capitulates.
It's quite interesting, because there are quite a lot of models that are used in business to identify types of people, political yeah. animals and DISC and that type of thing. Sometimes that can be very useful to understand how your teams respond, because everybody yeah. can respond in different ways depending on what their tendencies are. So that's,
yeah, absolutely. That one, The Four Tendencies, actually, I'll just briefly touch on it, actually. I read it about 3 years ago, and it helped me with my clients get to the point where it would normally take me a couple of months to get to, in terms of understanding them. Because it talks about the two main ones that you go in to see are obliger, which you'll just, if you ask them to do something, they'll do something. But you need to say, you need to actually want them to do it for you rather than do it for themselves. If you ask them to do it for themselves, they won't. It's just, so as a coach, it's like, I want my clients to like look, do self-care for their own self. And it's like, they don't do it. Whereas if like, if they're an obliger, and if I say to them, right, I want you to do the self-care and I want you to report back to me later on what you did, an obliger is going to do that. A questioner, and these are the ones that you'll see a lot of, and especially in a predominantly male industry like turfing and greenkeeping, is the questioner is, well, I want to know why we have to do this. I want to understand the logic behind it. And the thing is, you don't need to explain it in the logic that you want it. You need to explain it in the logic that they'll accept it. So that's one of the ones. And then upholders are easy. They just look after the rules. They're like Hermione Granger. It's like, you know, we should be here doing this the whole time. And And then rebels are the most complicated, but usually the most, often the most fun as well. So a rebel is someone who pushes back both at their own internal requests and pushes back at external requests. And the rebel's a really good one to give options to. So like, you know, which one of these do you prefer? You can do this now or you can do it later. Or like, whereas if you give a question or options, they'll be like, well, I want to know what's the best way to do it. So it's, you know, and that's the thing is you could be dealing with one of each of four of them in the space of a day and just wonder why. Well, this worked on John, but it doesn't work on Danny. It's like,
yeah, it is a challenge when you've got a team and everybody's you know, responds in different ways and has different drivers. Moving on from that, we've got, what's a good way of dealing with stress caused by colleagues? For example, if I am working flat out, but another person in my team is coasting by doing the bare minimum. That's a question that I'm sure a lot of people would want answered or feel that that happens in their teams.
That's the thing. I suppose this comes down to, again, like people's different maps of the world and different values. And the thing is, you're not working flat out to appease that person who's coasting. You're working flat out because you think it's the right thing to do. And if the pressure's coming from an external source, like your manager, that you should work flat out and the expectation doesn't appear to be there on other people, that's a slightly different issue. But again, an obliger will more often than not be the one who'll do the extra bit of overtime, work that little bit of flat out. Whereas the questioner would be like, well, why should I do that? And that will come into play there as well. Understand though that, but it's important for you to live to your values and to what's important for you. So in terms of the happiness comes from kind of, if you're satisfied with the job that you're doing, don't really try not to pay attention to what the other person's doing every single time. Like, this is one that I see on social media a hell of a lot. It's like, if you look at people, particularly if they're doing certain work and they're getting more attention than what yours is getting and all the rest of it, you think, oh, mine's way better than that, why is that happening? It's like, it's, you know, folks spending too much time focusing on other people just detracts us from what we're doing. So actually, it might be one of the contributing factors to why you feel you're working flat out, because you're also exhausting some of your energy thinking about what they're doing. If I look at other coaches and what they're doing too much, I get stuck in that trap myself, and it stops me from being creative. It makes me go into that, what am I doing wrong? Why am I, like, you know, and we, as we said before, we really don't want to go down that path. So yeah, just know what your principles are and your values are. And if your boss has taken advantage of the fact that you've in the past maybe been a bit of a people pleaser and stuff, know that that's a boomerang in itself. So that's one of a really big example of a boomerang, actually, is the fact that if you just say yes to your boss when really actually your values say I should be saying no, and I should be putting myself first a little bit here. The problem is, over time, those roles become established. And and what's really annoying is people don't seem to notice when someone's being consistently bad and someone's being consistently good. They notice when the person who's consistently bad has a really good day, or the person who's consistently good has a bad day. We notice things by comparison quite a lot. So it's really unfair, but you actually might be pulled up on the fact that if you have a day where you perform lower than what you would normally, and that person is just getting away with below that level all the time, it's unfair. Maybe speak to your manager about the fact that this is causing you a problem. But if that manager is expecting that extra work from you all the time and you're not personally comfortable with it, saying no is a full-on slingshot, because you think to yourself, oh, I can't say no, it's going to be uncomfortable. But what you end up doing is you have an uncomfortable conversation, and then you end up with changing the dynamic of the relationship, hopefully long term, to a way that actually suits you more. Whereas sometimes we say yes because it makes you feel comfortable in the moment to avoid the conflict, but then you sit there begrudgingly doing the extra work.
I mean, how do you open up those conversations though? You know, I think that's a challenge that a lot of people have, is you want to say no, but you don't know how to say it.
Yeah. Carefully. this is the thing, actually. It's one of those, the first step is the hardest. What I would say is to open up those conversations, get super clear on what the outcome of the conversation you want is before you go in. Prepare for that conversation. So actually write down what I want specifically. And then be as kind of forthright as that, really, to go in and say, you know, I've been working a lot of overtime recently, and that seems to become an expectation on me now. But if I'm being honest, I'm beginning to feel a little bit burned out, and I really struggle to say no to things. Be honest about these things, you know, be forthright about it, and then obviously, and because I'll use the analogy that I actually often say to my clients when I'm trying to get my clients to do a doctor referral. So if one of my clients needs anything beyond just a little bit of, you know, a bit of a mental mindset nudge and stuff, if they need a doctor's intervention, then I always push for that. But a lot of them struggle with it. And then they go and tell the doctor like 10% of what they've told me. And it's like, I've said to my clients a number of times, like, right, okay, the doctor isn't like a mechanic. They can't. You go in with a car, and the mechanic, you say to them, like, oh, my engine light's on, I think it's this. And it doesn't matter what you tell them. The mechanic can open up the hood, look inside, and figure it out. Doctors can only go off what you tell them. And people often, when we infer things, or we think we're implying things, the other person's not always picking up on those things. They're not opening up the hood and seeing what's truly under there. If you're just saying, you know, if your outside says, yeah, boss, I'll stay late again tonight, and you kind of think that I've got to put that happy face on for them while you're talking to it, they'll just assume that you're okay with it. And then they'll walk away, crack on with the rest of their day, but you'll be sat there the entire time, seething afterwards. So be clear on what you want and tell them what the current situation is. It means being uncomfortable. That's why it's a slingshot. It will be uncomfortable. And that's okay. It's supposed to be. A cool thing to check out for that is something called the 5-second rule. It's nothing to do with dropping food on the floor and picking it up, but it's by someone called Mel Robbins. Is that once you're clear on it, try not to then overthink it. It's important to think it through, but then it's like this, get your information. This is what I want to achieve from this conversation. And then, right, like basically 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, boss, can I have a word with you? And you want to act on it quite quickly, because the longer you do, you don't, your brain will just talk you out of it more and more.
Yeah, I suppose the idea of planning it and preparing yourself for it, yeah, actually stops the boiling point, really, doesn't it? Because otherwise you will react in a moment and just say, no, I'm just not going to do that, and yeah, and react negatively to actually something that could be resolved if you just sit down and talk about it. Clearly.
Yeah, 100%. And that's the same with those clients that I've mentioned, that when they need to go to the doctors, oftentimes it won't be that they don't really want to tell the doctor. It'll be like they'll get in there and the moment of this pressure and they get the brain fog. Yeah. So I'll actually say to them, well, let's write it all down, keep it on your phone. And if when you go in there, you don't send it to the doctor at all, then ask if you can actually send it as an email. And then it's like, and then it's that, and then the same with that situation. It would be better to do it face to face, because 95% of our communication is nonverbal. But if you get to the point that you really can't go in there, then yeah, you've already got it written down. You write, you know, as an email, and you can send it. That's a little bit easier to do than it is to obviously the face to face conversation. But as I think you get much more of the you get much more of a benefit of actually having the face to face.
Yeah. So we're living in very strange times, as everybody's talking about at the moment. So if you've never particularly suffered from symptoms of stress before, I think we're now finding everybody's finding themselves in situations where they're just not quite able to comprehend what's going on in their brains. Yeah. But how might you recognize symptoms of stress? I think for most people, the trigger is fairly obvious at the moment, but outside of this crisis that we find ourselves in, how would you recognize what the trigger might be?
So by trigger, do you mean what is causing you stress?
Yeah.
You're getting caused stress by hundreds of things. Like, it's like everything to a degree is causing you stress. And that sounds like a little bit of an exaggeration, but I was actually just explaining this to my son before, like my eldest son, because I said to him, like, in our household, my kids are my wife's stepkids. So like, if the kids want a parent, they never go to their stepmom, they go to me. Like, even, and they never go to each other to solve the problems out either. So they come to me. And if my wife wants something, she never goes to the kids, she comes to me. And like, we've been on holidays where my mum like is with us and stuff, and my mum would never go to any of the other three, she'd come to me. So, and I'm like, again, I kind of like that. I like being the kind of the helper, but the helper gets gets exhausted. And so many of the people out there that are the obligers that are in there will be that person that is the strong one, and they've been so used to just handling everything. And what happens is over time, that person just gets chipped away at. And when we tend to notice stress is when we go below a certain threshold. And the first time I actually did a talk on stress, I called it me again. Because what people say when they hit that is like, I don't feel like myself anymore. I just want to feel like me again. Now, I often say, in fact, let's see if I've got that in a slide. I think I do, because just in case we needed any extra stuff, I put this on in depression, but it worked. This self-care slide picture that's on screen now, if you look, I'm stood on a box of self-care in the shallow end of the pool, and my head's above the water. So the things I'm doing for myself are keeping my head above the water. Very good analogy for where we are right now. The same amount of self-care is not going to get my head above the water. And the thing is, once the head goes below, we get to that position where we feel like we're drowning, we feel like we're struggling, we become symptomatic. And symptomatic of stress can be anxiety, can be depression, can be turning to alcohol, can be screaming at the kids, can be screaming into a pillow, can be wanting to take a baseball bat to a lamp. You know, it's like there's many different kind of symptoms of stress. I've had clients that have literally blacked out from stress. And it's like almost like the brain saying, you're not taking any time off, so I'm going to take some time off for you. Yeah. And that's the thing, is the other thing that a lot of people that get into that situation, they'll turn around and say to people, oh, I'm really struggling. And they'll hear the following thing. How can you be struggling? You're the one who's always helping people. And it's like, that's like driving your car around all day, and when it runs out of petrol, looking at it and going, how can you be out of petrol? You've been driving me around all day. It's like the people who help people and the people who are obligers in particular, like I'm one myself, which is why I understand it so well. They need that time too. And I was explaining to my son this earlier. I said, look, I don't want you to stop coming to me, but I just want you to be mindful of the fact that you're coming to me. You know, you're coming to me, like Ilona's coming to me, Joe's coming to me. If grandma wants something, she's coming to me. If my clients, who are, you know, a lot of them are struggling more in this period of time, so they're wanting more contact. So I'm under, and it's not that any single one of those things is the problem. It's the culmination of it. So how we recognize it, be mindful of that. Be mindful of the fact that there are little bits and pieces coming from different angles. The obvious ones will be obvious. Like the things that are really causing you problems will be obvious, and it's easy to point to those. I'd actually say if the ones that you can minimize, if you can minimize a few of those little ones, or if you can increase the amount of self-care, then that's going to be, and think about it, you start self-care proactively as well, because we treat self-care as like a painkiller. We notice that we're stressed, now we go to the self-care. Right, we need to treat self-care a little bit like a multivitamin. Do something off that take-up menu every day before you need it, because it's more beneficial before you need it as well. It's like, you'll feel like it works 10% better if you use it when you're already feeling okay.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good way to deal with it. Well, I think we've been going nearly 55 minutes, so I think we'll end it there. We've got no more questions coming in on the chat. So on screen, Dave has just flicked up the CPD code for today's webinar. So you may also be interested to watch Dave's presentation from this year's Turf Managers Conference, which can be found on the Bigger website. This webinar will be available in the members area of the Bigger website within the next few hours. So if you want to rewatch and re-listen to what Dave's had to say and the chat that we've had, then please do. I'd like to thank everybody for joining us and hope that you'll join us again soon. For details about future Continue to Learn Extra webinars, please visit the What's On page of the Bigger website. So I'd like to finish here by saying thanks so much, Dave. It's been a really interesting nearly an hour, and we really appreciate it. And we hope that you stay well and stay safe.
My pleasure. It's been great.
Thanks so much.
No worries.
I will speak to you soon.
The Green Room Golf Course podcast is produced by myself, Carl Hansel, on behalf of the British and International Golf Greenkeepers Association. For questions, comments and concerns, you can get in touch with me by emailing carl@bigger.co.uk. That's Carl with a K. You can also join the conversation on social media using @greenroombigger. And we've also got a Facebook page where all the latest notices, news releases and information from Bigger can be found. We're also on Instagram using @bigger_HQ. subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. The more people know about the sports turf industry, the more understanding they will have about the hard work of bigger members and other greenkeepers. And speaking of bigger membership, if you're inspired by what you hear to progress your career in greenkeeping, then a major first step is signing up to the association. The opportunities for career development are countless and potentially life-changing, such as volunteer opportunities at major tournaments and educational opportunities across Europe and the USA. Don't forget, if you're a golfer and you've got any questions about anything you hear on the podcast, have a conversation with the greenkeepers at your club. They've got the expertise to explain what's happening at the course and how it fits into the team's long-term vision to improve playability and enjoyment of the facility.